Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back. And it is now or never. And that debt is fraud. And folks, we need to focus on compliance with the Constitution. We need to be supporting those who are willing to become champions for us in public office, like Jerry Winstrand. And we need you to support Jerry in his campaign in Missouri. And without any further ado, I don't want to go into a really long monologue. I will just be happy to bring and welcome Sean back. Welcome back, Sean. And I will just start it off with this.
Thank you, sir.
I may not be the first person, but I am glad to become a member of the choir of singing praise to the ratification debates. Now, that choir was very, very small. When I discovered the ratification debates, it was back in the 90s, with the advent of the internet and so forth, and I kind of tripped across the Constitution Society. I've kind of noticed that John Rowland, who kind of created that, who was, you know, a constitutional scholar in Texas, he had the ratification debates plugged up there on his website. I go, that's kind of cool. This is neat. This is neat stuff. But, you know, at that point in time, I was like everybody else, wired on the Federalist Papers, not knowing the poisonous pill. And unfortunately, John didn't see and identify the Federalist Papers as a poisonous pill, because he had them up there. And he, you know, I don't know if he's still alive or not. I've kind of mentioned before that I know his health has been bad over the past 10 years, on and off. I have no idea. He's older than me, but he's not older than the hills. Maybe dustier, because I know I'm dustier than the hills, but anyway, that all being said, I'm glad that I'm a newfound member and have been for well over 10 years since I wrote my first book, well before that. And actually, in the research of my first book, I actually found the Documentation History Center of the Ratification of the Constitution, the HRC, in the University of Wisconsin, where here the University of Wisconsin made this huge, you know, bicentennial effort of recognizing the Constitution by creating the documentation history of the Constitution or the ratification of the Constitution. And so they've got this huge, you know, piece of property up there in the University of Wisconsin that's been dedicated to this in, what do you call that, where you got this, it's like a dome, a domed room or what have you. Anyway, what they did was they kind of puffed their chest out and said, look what we're going to do. And then it seemed like it just became old news because, one, the effort of going through and documenting the entire history, what they did was they got all the different letters from the different delegates that were in the ratification process and the Constitutional Convention, all of these documents that led to the Constitution, the stuff that we cover. They got them all together, and they kind of put them together, and they hard-bound these things into this huge volume. And I would love to see this done. As far as I'm concerned, this is the national treasure, what they did. They made a big, you know, stink about, hey, look at what we're doing. And I believe that after they started going through the ratification debates and really reading them, because this was in 1976, and I think when they started reading them as a bunch of communist liberals that was running that school, said, you know what, we don't want people to read these things. We're just going to go on the lowdown here and just get this done, because we don't want to abandon this, because then people would say, well, why did you abandon that work? So they just figured that they would just walk across the finish line and just, you know, I'm trying to remember what we called it, because we had them at where I worked. you know, a domed area where you can actually stand there and you can kind of hear an echo and so forth, because that's rotunda. They call the room or the area with the DHRC, it's the rotunda. And it's the same thing with, I think, where Jefferson's papers are, that type of stuff. So anyway, it's a way of denoting, you know, something of importance. Anyway, so the point is it frustrates me that all of this documentation is sitting there in hard copy. They could easily make this all soft copy, all searchable, that type of stuff, and actually promulgate this out so that every state legislature had their hands on it. I get the fact that, you know, they did this so that they could raise money, you know, in, you know, what they have done to share this knowledge. But as far as I'm concerned, this is not copyrightable. This is public domain stuff. And whether, you know, they like it or not, whether they make money on it or not, I mean, shame on them for what they've done in trying to suppress this and not, you know, get this out and help everybody understand how important this is. But I'm happy to be a member of the choir now in helping everybody understand the significance of the ratification debates and how plain and simple, as these men debated what this Constitution said and what it meant. Boy, you can't beat this. I mean, this is the national treasure. So before we ended, I started talking about Dr. Taylor making a complaint. And so we were going to pick up with that. And Sean, are you ready?
Yes, sir.
Okay, well, let's go ahead.
Dr. Taylor said the consideration of the eighth section had taken up a great deal of time. The gentleman had repeated the same arguments over and over again, and although the order of the convention was that the proposed constitution should be considered by paragraphs, he was pleased, he said, to observe that the honorable gentleman, fast speaking, had gone into the matter at large, and therefore he hoped that other gentlemen would take the same liberty and that all further observations might be on the system at large.
Okay, because we didn't actually cover this, but if you read, they decided, because they figured, you know, do they want to nitpick or do they want to go through this line by line? And the logical course was to go through it line by line. Every state kind of came to that same conclusion. Let's go through this line by line. Every state got derailed by the anti-federals because they wanted to jump ahead to the parts that they didn't like. Well, you don't worry about this. What's important is it's got this evil in it, this right here. You like that oath thing. That's okay, but this is really evil. It doesn't have a Bill of Rights. They were trying to make and get people focused on those things that they thought would be worthy of dismissing and rejecting the Constitution. And so this is not an uncommon comment, but I think it's kind of interesting that, you know, he kind of applauded or, you know, praised somebody for fast speaking and speaking in general instead of nitpicking into the points. But the eighth section, the reason the eighth section was so heavily debated was because those were the powers. Those are the enumerations of powers. This is the only part that Congress has the authority to create law according to these things, these objects. This is where a uniform rule of naturalization and uniform bankruptcy laws and so forth. I mean, Section 8 is where they have their power. Okay, so let's go down to the religious tests under Mr. Parson. Go ahead.
It has been objected that the Constitution provides no religious test by oath, and we may have in power unprincipled men, atheists, and pagans. No man can wish more ardently than I do that all of our public officers may be filled by men who fear God and hate wickedness, but it must remain with the electors to give the government this security. An oath will not do it. Will an unprincipled man be entangled by an oath? Will an atheist or a pagan dread the vengeance of the Christian's God, a being, in his opinion, the creature of fancy and Credulity. It is a solecism in expression. No man is so illiberal as to wish the confining places of honor or profit to any one sect of Christians. But what security is it to government that every public officer shall swear that he is a Christian? For what will then be called Christianity? One man will declare that the Christian religion is only an illumination of natural religion, and that he is a Christian. Another Christian will assert that all men must be happy hereafter in spite of themselves. A third Christian reverses the image and declares that let a man do all he can, he will certainly be punished in another world. And a fourth will tell us that if a man use any force for the common defense, he violates every principle of Christianity. Third, the only evidence we can have of the sincerity of a man's religion is a good life. And I trust that such evidence will be required of every candidate by every elector. That man who acts an honest part to his neighbor will most probably conduct honorably towards the public. It has been objected that we have not as good security against abuse of power under the new Constitution as the Confederation gives us. It is my deliberate opinion that we have a better security. Under the Confederation, the whole power, executive and legislative, is vested in one body in which the people have no representation, and where the states, the large and the small states, are equally represented. And all the checks the states have is a power to remove and disgrace an unfaithful servant after the mischief is perpetrated. Under this Constitution, an equal representation immediately from the people is introduced, who, by their negative and the exclusive right of originating money bills, have the power to control the Senate, where the sovereignty of the states is represented. But it has been objected that, in the old Confederation, the states could at any time recall their delegates, and there was a rotation. No essential benefit could be derived to the people from these provisions, but great inconveniences will result from them. It has been observed by a gentleman who has argued against the Constitution that a representative ought to have an intimate acquaintance with the circumstances of his constituents, and, after comparing them with the situation of every part of the Union, so conduct as to promote the common good. The sentiment is an excellent one and ought to be engraved on the hearts of every representative. But what is the effect of the power of recalling? Your representative, with an operating revocation over his head, will lose all ideas of the general good and will dwindle to serve to a servile agent attempting to serve local and partial benefits by cabal and intrigue. There are great and insuperable objections to a rotation. It is an abridgment of the rights of the people, and it may deprive them at critical seasons of the services of the most important characters in the nation. It deprives a man of honorable ambition, whose highest duty is the applause of his fellow citizens, of an efficient motive to great and patriotic exertions. The people, individually, have no method of testifying their esteem but by a reflection, and shall they be deprived of the honest satisfaction of wreathing for their friend and patriot a crown of laurel more durable than monarchy can bestow? It has been objected that the Senate are made too dependent upon the state legislatures. No business under the Constitution of the Federal Convention could have been more embarrassing than the constructing the Senate, as that body must conduct our foreign negotiations and establish and preserve a system of national politics, a uniform adherence to which can alone induce other nations to negotiate with and confide in us. It is certain the change of the men who compose it should not be too frequent and should be gradual. At the same time, suitable checks should be provided to prevent an abuse of power and to continue their dependence on their constituents. I think the convention have most happily extricated themselves from the embarrassment. Although the senators are elected for 6 years, yet the Senate, as a body composed of the same men, can exist only for 2 years without the consent of the states. If the states think proper, one-third of that body may, at the end of every second year, be new men. When the Senate act as legislators, they are controllable at all times by the representatives, and in their executive capacity, in making treaties and conducting national negotiations, the consent of two-thirds is necessary, who must be united to a man, which is hardly possible, or the new men biennially sent to the Senate, if the state chooses it, can control them. And at all times, there will also be one-third of the Senate who, at the expiration of 2 years, must obtain a re-election or return to the mass of the people. And change of men in the Senate will be so gradual as not to destroy or disturb any national system of politics. It is objected that it is dangerous to allow the Senate a right of proposing alterations or amendments in money bills, that the Senate may by this power increase the supplies and establish profuse salaries, that for these reasons the Lords in the British Parliament have not this power, which is a great security to the liberties of Englishmen. I was much surprised at hearing this objection and the grounds upon which it was supported. The reason why the Lords have not this power is founded on a principle in the English Constitution that the Commons alone represent the whole property of the nation, and as a money bill is a grant to the King, none can make the grant but those who represent the property of the nation. And the negative of the Lords is introduced to check the profusion of the Commons and to guard their own property. The matter of passing the money bill is conclusive evidence of these principles. For after the assent of the Lords, it does not remain with the clerk of the Parliament, but is returned to the Commons, who by their Speaker present it to the King as the gift of the Commons. But every supposed control of the Senate by this power may have over money bills, they can have without it. For by private communications with the representatives, they may as well insist upon the increase of the supplies or salaries as by official communications. But had not the Senate this power, the representatives might take any foreign matter to a money bill and compel the Senate to concur or lose the supplies. This might be done in critical seasons when the Senate might give way to the encroachments of the representatives rather than sustain the odium of embarrassing the affairs of the nation. The balance between the two branches of the legislature would, in this way, be endangered, if not destroyed, and the Constitution materially injured. This subject was fully considered by the Convention for forming the Constitution of Massachusetts, and the provision made by that body after mature deliberation is introduced into the federal Constitution. It was objected that by giving Congress a power of direct taxation, we give them power to destroy the state governments by prohibiting them from raising any monies. But this objection is not founded in the Constitution. Congress have only a concurrent right with each state in laying direct taxes, not an exclusive right. And the right of each state to direct taxation is equally extensive and perfect as the right of Congress. Any law, therefore, of the United States for securing the Congress more than a concurrent right with each state is usurpation and void. It has been objected that we have no Bill of Rights. If gentlemen who make this objection would consider what are the supposed inconveniences resulting from the want of a Declaration of Rights, I think they would soon satisfy themselves that the objection has no weight. Is there a single natural right we enjoy, uncontrolled by our own legislature, that Congress can infringe? Not one. Is there a single political right secured to us by our Constitution against the attempts of our own legislature, which we are deprived of by this Constitution? Not one that I recollect. All the rights Congress can control, we have surrendered to our own legislature. And the only question is whether the people shall take from their own legislatures a certain portion of the several sovereignties and unite them in one head for the more effectual securing of the national prosperity and happiness.
Okay, so that was a mouthful, but he covers a lot here. And I could have broken it up a little bit because he continues on and we're going to read further. And I probably should. And as a matter of fact, what I will do, because I want to start off at the top of what we kind of covered here, what you covered, because it talks about this thing about the oath of office. And for the first, I'll just say the first three paragraphs, he provides this insight
of how important the, you know, having an oath of office is. It's far more important than a religious test. The one thing that they didn't really focus on was the limitation of powers. Again, in tying everything together, you know, we constantly, you know, get all upset because they're doing things they don't have the authority to do. Well, it's easy. They can't do it. And if they're doing something that the U.S. Constitution doesn't allow them to do, and they voted for it, they put the bill forward, they voted, they supported a violation of the Constitution, what was glaring right there at the end of their nose, like Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, was there was nothing in this Constitution that could actually invoke or hold them directly accountable. In other words, in the Constitution, if the president commits treason, bribery, you know, these different kinds of crimes he can be impeached for, he gets impeached. And they can, one, indict him and then impeach him. The indictment comes from the House, and then the Senate determines whether he's to be removed or not. That's the whole process is really well laid out in the Constitution. Well, what about everybody else? What about the judges? What about the Senate? What about everybody else? There needed to be something else, and what they did was they just placed these little notations that each house of the Congress will hold each other accountable for their behavior. I mean, it's, in other words, they actually, I'm surprised they didn't understand, and nobody said, hey, you're creating dens of thieves in the federal court, in the Senate, and in the House of Representatives. Because you're leaving it to them. When we can't do that, we need these hardcore checks and balances. So this is where there was completely a lack of understanding. I mean, he's going on and on about the importance of the oath. Absolutely. That oath is a legal binding commitment that they must support the Constitution over everything. He talks about, and we've heard others talk about, you know, taking care of their constituents. That's not, they don't swear an oath to do that. If they take care of their constituents, then it's identified, and they've kind of talked about that supporting a cabal, what have you. So what I'm highlighting here, folks, is they really didn't understand that they were missing this one piece, Section 3 of the 14th Amendment. And there's only one that knew it was necessary. But at this point in time, they couldn't see, you know, that the object right there staring them in the face. It was right there. They couldn't see the forest through the trees. Or they would have put Section 3 of the 14th Amendment in the Constitution, and we wouldn't have had to wait for the Civil War to finally get an accountability for every public servant to that legal oath. And so it's just like, duh, you know, talk about an epiphany. Section 3 of the 14th Amendment was the epiphany that all these men were talking, but nobody could really put their nail on the head. If the anti-federalists were brilliant, they would have been able to identify that weak link and that weak point to say, hey, and they would have been able to drive that amendment. But see, the point is the anti-federalists didn't care. They wanted government out of control because their government was out of control and they wanted to maintain that. And as soon as the Constitution was ratified, where did the anti-federalists go? They went straight into the Federalist seats in Congress and into the states, and they started getting corrupt themselves and created a bigger cabal, a national cabal. So the very first three paragraphs really kind of highlight this as far as I'm concerned. And then the next paragraph, he kind of dives into the importance of the classes that I think most people don't realize, you know, the classes of the Senate, the every 2 years rotation. Because you can really have a profound effect, but we've never leveraged that. We've never leveraged that. And as a matter of fact, he talks about how the states have that power. And and this is why that article, The Truth About the 17th Amendment, is so important, folks. If the state legislatures actually took back control of the Senate, which they have the constitutional right to do, most all our problems would go away with that. We'll be right back.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so again, he was highlighting this beautiful thing about being able to remove one-third of the Senate every 2 years and kind of have this, you know, wake-up call. And then he goes through, you know, these other really important parts in the highlights of the salary and so forth of England and America and all of that. And then he talks about this whole point of the rights. And so that last highlighted part, is there a single natural right we enjoy uncontrolled by our own legislature that Congress can infringe? In other words, is there any power that says that they can control our religious expression? No. Is there any power that they can control our speech? No. How about our right of assembly? Our right of petitioning for the redress of grievance? No, no, no. They don't have the delegated power to infringe upon our rights. They can only act upon those powers granted. They can't assume new powers without an amendment. And so this was just another really succinct way of just basically saying the same thing. So now he talks about the acts of usurpation not obligatory by law, and he kind of wraps it up with that. So let's go ahead and do the wrap-up on the usurpations. Go ahead, Sean.
I wanted to bring up a couple of items.
Okay, sure. Absolutely.
They're along the same lines. And a couple of paragraphs earlier where he says, if the people duly attend to the objects of their choice, it would be realized. Then again, in this last section that I just read, he talks about no man can wish more ardently than I do that all public officers are filled by men who fear God and hate wickedness. But it must remain with the electors to give the government this security. An oath will not do it. Will an unprincipled man be entangled by an oath? So again, it comes back down to the people and who we elect to be our representatives.
Right. Absolutely. So, excuse me. So as we look at what we have to do, well, what is the process? How do we start realizing the limited powers and enforce compliance? How can we do that?
We find people who understand these foundational principles and elect them to office so they can do the job that was intended, instead of these people that are elected by faction for benefit of whatever myopic cause or intention that the groups have that are backing these people. You know, like there's a big controversy going on right now in Maine over Plattner, and everybody's willing to overlook all of the horrible things that he's done just like recently and still to this day, because there you have a chance to get him elected and he'll be their guy. And no one, you know, there's no accounting for any kind of principled ideas or foundational policies or anything like that. It's all about who they think they can get to win, you know, and it doesn't matter what his character is. And it's just, I think, a very good example of what we're talking about here.
So Madison and the framers kind of pointed that the people are the fountain of political power, that the only way true change can be realized or actualized is when enough of the people take a stand. So I got an idea. Why not start organizing at the county level constitutional compliance committees? Have a constitutional compliance committee formed by your county government and get your county parties to create a committee as well in driving petitions into your county government to get and help drive. Because, see, you could have a Thomas Jefferson and you can have a James Madison. And when they went and took on the state governments of the Union at the time, what was there, 15, 16 governments at that? I think there was 16. It was before, yeah, 1798, it was 16. So the point is that they took on the state governments to say, hey, we can't allow the federal government to continue doing these things. We have to step in. Well, 14 of the 16 said, hey, you're wrong. And show us, you know, how we're wrong, because they basically rejected their resolutions of Kentucky and Virginia. So what did they do? They went to where the power was. They used the party, and they awoken the people of the United States, of the Union, to get them to say, you need to stand up and demand compliance and keep government in check. And the only way we're going to do that is get rid of these bad people. Now, that was kind of a, that was done one in a year's time, and only two rock stars could do it, Madison and Jefferson being those two rock stars. But more importantly, they did it instead of actually what we have to do. Because, folks, we don't have a rock star today like Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. Believe me, I've been looking. We don't have one. Even if you got, you know, I don't care, you're Glenn Beck or you're Sean Hannity, you're Mark Levin. I mean, for some reason, none of these guys are even interested in solving the problem. And that's only because they're making millions of dollars because the problem exists. You realize that when somebody is making money because the problem exists, they have no vested interest whatsoever of killing the problem, because it kills their source of revenue. This is basic business stuff, folks. And so if we want our government back, we have to take it back. So there is a mechanism and there's a way of doing this. And this is by what our founders, and we started this year off going through the Tory Acts and showing you how the people locally organized. They started locally educating themselves on the rights of the Englishman. They started using petitions in holding the king accountable. This is what has to be done at the county level. Now, you could, like I said, if you had a Thomas Jefferson at your county level, a real rock star, he's not rock star enough to take on the state. He has to have the perception of the people behind him. If the people aren't behind him, or at least this perception is created because if they're carrying these petitions signed off by the people, if they're just one in taking a stand up against the state, then the state will come after them and crush them. They know they can't crush them in their own county if they're beloved of the county. If the county loves what they're doing and the fact that they're taking on tyranny, there's a symbiotic relationship that needs to be developed between your county legislators and you, the people. This is why it doesn't just end with creating this Constitutional Compliance Committee. The parties themselves have to surrender to their job, because what is the party? The party is the grassroots of the political movement of the people. And if the party puts aside all of its agendas and says it's all about compliance, full compliance with the Constitution, holding everybody accountable,
That changes everything, folks. That literally is talking our talk. That is talking the game plan of winning. I can't say it any more simpler or any plainer than that. That is what has to happen. In doing that, you will see his hand move forth and miracles will be performed. And I say that because history has only proven this. History has proven that when the people, you know, unite in calling upon heaven, it actually, and he's given us everything. All we've got to do is recognize what he gave us and use it. It's kind of like Moses picking up the staff and holding the staff up and healing Israel. All we have to do is look. All we have to do is sign these petitions and demand these good men be held accountable and that they hold everybody else accountable. Once we have accountability running rampant through our government and through our halls of justice and so forth, you will see those changes and it will be awestruck. You will actually be humbled in saying, why didn't we do this sooner? It's that simple. And I'm probably just the guy to poke everybody in the eye saying, I've been saying this. It's that simple. Come on, get on the program here, folks. Is it not that simple?
Oh, it is that simple. Like we always say, it's like the gospel. It's very simple. Yeah, people can take it and construe it in different ways to fit whatever narrative they're trying to purport.
Yep.
But it doesn't change the foundations. And
yep.
You're absolutely right. It's up to us, and that's the way it has to be.
Yep.
You know, and that's what I was talking about, changing this whole paradigm where the government, we expect the government, and I've always asked and wondered in my mind when people talk about, oh, they shouldn't do this, or they did that, or they, who is they? They are the people that are supposed to be representing us, and if they're not, then we need to enact our will, and that's what God has given us. He's given us our liberty if we're willing to take up the mantle and be vigilant and ensure that it is protected. That's the whole role of government to start with. And we have this paradigm now where the government's supposed to take care of you and provide for you. And that's been intentionally indoctrinated into society to where that's the way most people think about it nowadays. And this information and knowledge that we're going through, once people understand it, and just like we always talk about, like the scriptures, you're just going to learn more and more as you go through it, and you'll see things that in a way that you didn't see them before. And that's what my hope and my mission is to try to get people to understand these foundational principles, because I think the majority of Americans nowadays have no idea what freedom really means, what, you know, individual freedom is.
So ambiguity is our big enemy, because if we don't understand the facts, if we don't understand that there's a tool, if we don't understand that they're hard bound, that they can only do these very specific things, our lack of understanding puts us into the field of ambiguity. And this is where everybody's feelings come in, and all of a sudden, excuse the expression, we all of a sudden have this huge pee post. Everybody wants to pee their opinions on it and make their mark. It's not about that.
It's more the moral relativity that's been indoctrinated into us, that everybody sees the government as their own, a reflection of their own values and morals and ideas, and that's never what it was intended to be.
No, it's been very specified, very clearly defined and delineated. This is all it is. Not what you want it to be. Correct. And when everybody puts aside that paradigm and realizes what is it that they can actually, where is their authority? What's in these constitutions? This is why the committee, the first thing your county committee is going to do, your county government committee is going to audit the federal and state constitution and county constitutions. What authority has been delegated to the federal government? What authority has been delegated to the state government? what authority has been delegated to the county government? And then you look at what each of these governments are doing and say, well, they don't have the authority to do all of these things. Boom, it's gone. They can't do it. When you start understanding how beautiful and how simple it was to create a very specific delegated, or I would call a power of attorney, a specified limited power of attorney, by creating a constitution that was in that fashion of a contract that tied their hands, that they could only do these things, it will become, and I don't want to use the word savior, but it becomes whether we get destroyed and trampled upon or whether we can actually be restored as a nation without harm. Because when the debtors come, they equally have the blood on their hands as these criminals that have been in office selling us downriver to them. They have been in cahoots, and they both have blood on their hands, and they have no standing. We have all the standing because they utilized authorities they didn't have. They usurped power and authority that they weren't granted to create the debt, to do all of these things that they've been doing. You can't tell me that this is divine, or that this isn't divine, I should say. That's the better way. Because when you really look at it, wow, what a beautiful thing this Constitution actually is. It provides the pathway of healing this nation in its entirety. But most of it is on us. We have to heal the morals. We have the ability to get government into only doing those things empowered, but we have to go and actually reprogram ourselves to get aligned with what this Constitution can do. And how much better off we would be if, you know, now that we're a mature nation, we can see and learn from our own mistakes and go, wow, all we need to do is do these things and keep the federal government out of these issues, these matters, domestic matters and so forth. So anyway, so let's go down further. And where are we at? So if I remember correctly, we're down.
Acts of usurpation.
Yeah, the acts of usurpation are not obligatory by law. Now, this goes down, and I'll wait till this is done, because this is just a fancy way of saying nullification, but let's go ahead.
Honorable gentleman from Boston has stated at large most of the checks the people have against usurpation and the abuse of power under the proposed Constitution. But from the abundance of his matter, he has, in my opinion, omitted two or three, which I shall mention. The oath the several legislative, executive, and judicial officers of the several states take to support the federal Constitution is as effectual a security against the usurpation of the general government as it is against the encroachment of the state governments. For an increase of the powers by usurpation is as clearly a violation of the federal Constitution as a diminution of these powers by private encroachment, and that the oath obliges the officer of the several states as vigorously to oppose the one as the other. But there is another check, founded in the nature of the Union, superior to all the parchment checks that can be invented. If there should be a usurpation, it will not be on the farmer and merchant, employed and attentive only to their several occupations. It will be upon 13 legislatures, completely organized, possessed of the confidence of the people, and having the means as well as inclination successfully to oppose it. Under these circumstances, none but madmen would attempt a usurpation. But, sir, the people themselves have it in their power effectually to resist usurpation without being driven to an appeal to arms. An act of usurpation is not obligatory. It is not law, and any man may be justified in his resistance. Let him be considered as a criminal by the general government, yet only his own fellow citizen can convict him. They are his jury, and if they pronounce him innocent, not all the powers of Congress can hurt him, and innocent they certainly will pronounce him if the supposed law he resisted was an act of usurpation.
Now, by that, one would think that one person could stand up against this corrupt system. But he's not talking about a corrupt system. He's talking about a system that has gone, that has begun to go awry. When a system goes awry and keeps going awry and keeps going further and further sideways to a point where everybody involved is vested in protecting the corruption, then you have to get rid of, because this is a mathematical thing. How many federal judges, how many employees in the federal court system are there? That's a specific number, folks. How many people in Congress are there? Specific number. How many people within the presidency and the executive administrations? Specific number. How many people in the state legislatures? Another number. And the state courts? Another number. And how many people in the county legislatures and the county courts? It still comes up that that is a small fraction of the people of America. And that as you start taking your state back, by taking your county back first, then all of a sudden everybody starts shifting in realizing that, you know, we're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. But if we get it right, the elixir is far, the elixir may be bitter, but is far less deadly and far less poisonous than allowing this to continue. That's exactly what Milton Friedman stated. That, yeah, the solution is going to be a bitter solution. We're going to have austerity. But that austerity is pale in comparison to the misery and anguish we will lose and suffer in losing all of our liberties and losing this government we've been blessed with. How dare us think that we could just, you know, let it go a little bit longer, kick the can down the road, and think, well, that's a better option than tasting the bitterness, because every day we wait, the bitterness gets a little bit stronger. And we have to realize, oh, shoot, I'm not going to have this revenue income, or, you know, I'm not going to have these government benefits. They're not going to pay my electrical bill. They're not going to, you know, pay for my, you know, my trash bill. All these little benefits that they've given everybody, that all these people that have applied for, the handouts, those go away because they don't have the authority to do those things. They've just been buying us off, and we're equally a part of this. We have to shuck them off first before we can expect those people in office to do it. Are we willing to actually take that stand? Or are we adult enough? Are you man and woman enough to actually stand up and say enough's enough? Because that's really what it comes down to. That's the way I see it. Comments?
I totally agree, sir. And I mean, it might not be specifically related to this, but you were talking about austerity and people, there definitely will have to be some kind of pain that people will have to feel. But if we continue going down this road, the pain is going to be so much more worse and incurable.
But let me just say this too, because you'd be surprised. I always have these little anecdotes or these little, you know, sayings or what have you. One of my sayings is that one of the greatest things about being alive on this earth is the people. Because we are in his image, and we have the ability to be in his likeness. But one of the worst things about living here is the people, because they can become so evil, so corrupt, and so satanic, so demonic. And so when we actually take back and we're committed to doing the right thing, just think about this, folks. We've created a community that's actually going to, we're all going to suffer. We're all going to be in, we will not be alone. And we will be able to pick ourselves up by our bootstraps as a community. So why think that you're going to be standing alone? You're not going to be the only one missing something. You're not going to be the only one without. When
The grocery stores are empty. We're all going to have to pull together resources and start boiling dandelion roots or whatever there is in the yards and so forth to start harvesting and sharing to keep everybody alive. Whatever we have to go through, whatever that austerity is, we can overcome. There has come points in time where he has fed us with manna.
Amen.
If we do it, he will bless us and we will overcome. In every case of the cause of liberty, he has blessed us. And history is on our side with this. Now, Mr. Dawes goes into a little diatribe, and it's more than we have time for, talking about guns. And this is, let me see here, down on Thursday, January the 24th, we're going to kick it off in our next episode on guns, and then we'll get into the exclusive legislation and so forth, and we're going to be getting really, really, really close to where we're towards the very end and where the Honorable Mr. our President Hancock, John Hancock, steps in. We're getting closer and closer. So with that, any other parting shots? The last 2 minutes is yours, if you want. Go ahead.
There was something I wanted to talk about. Go ahead. There's a quote that Don Wildman popularized that's based on Romans 5:3-4. We also rejoice in our sufferings because we know that suffering produces perseverance, perseverance character, and character hope. And I hear a lot of people talking nowadays about the younger generation losing hope. And you have to have that hope founded in something. Hope isn't something you just snatch out of the air. You know, it has to be based on something that's real and something that's righteous. So I think that our hope is in reclaiming the republic and reclaiming our liberty, as we were talking about in the process that we're talking about, because we still, no matter what, how bad it might be or how wicked things are with the government, we still have the authority, you know, from God to reclaim that, to reclaim our sovereignty.
Who does not have the authority to cast Satan away from us? But how
Who
many
does
times
not have the authority?
Right.
All of us do.
But my point is, how many times and how often when we're dealing with the demons in our lives, have you ever? Because there's way too many people that have never uttered the words, get thee behind me, Satan. Folks.
Every day, brother.
Folks. The only reason we're dealing with demons is because we're not casting the demons out.
Amen.
So let's say this. We got New Year's resolutions coming, but maybe we can start now and just maybe immortalizing that little phrase, get thee behind me, Satan, and actually start using that when we're starting to deal with demons, whether that be in our head or verbally. We need to start using that because, folks, the act of creating constitutional compliance and demanding full compliance of the Constitution, all of this is the same thing as get thee behind me, Satan. It's taking our authority back over the government that we have, or taking our authority of the space that we have that Satan is trying to frustrate us over or take away from us. Anyway, thank you very much for your time today, Sean. Folks, I hope that this is, you know, every day I hope it makes more and more sense. We're here to help. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.